To go ahead and proceed generally in the sequence that is listed in our agenda. However, we have a couple individuals who we'd asked to come down and testify earlier on one of our hearings last week on Senate Bill 323, folks representing the Surplus Lines Association, and we kind of got into our discussion at that earlier hearing. They have asked for an opportunity. We asked them to come back and share with us some amendments. And because they've got a time constraint, because this is the second day we've asked them to come down, I'd like to go ahead and take them out of order, and then we'll go ahead with the top of our agenda. So Mr. Wilson and Mr. Marks, on behalf of the Surplus Lines Association, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'd like to thank the committee for inviting us back a second time to finish the discussion of the two amendments that the Surplus Lines Association has proposed. My name is Joel Wilson. I'm the attorney for the Surplus Lines Association, and with me is Barney Marks, the examiner for that association. It is not clear in our reading of the bill whether certain sections of it were intended to apply to surplus lines carriers or not. The bill in several sections refers to authorized companies, which of course would be admitted companies, but because it's unclear, we have are proposing that the committee adopt an amendment to make it clear that it does not apply to surplus lines carriers in the areas of cancellation and non-renewal. The reason is we feel that that would have an adverse effect on the availability of surplus lines coverage in the state of Oregon. As we explained to the committee last time, surplus lines coverage is a fairly small part of the market, about 2 to 4% of the premium dollars in Oregon currently. However, it's an important part of the market because it's a safety net for areas for which admitted carriers do not provide coverage. Coverage can only be placed with a non-admitted company if a majority of those admitted companies do not write the kind of insurance or in the quantity needed. So this type of insurance picks up coverage for daycare centers, liquor liability, tow truck drivers, things that fall outside the coverage provided by admitted markets. And that gap varies with the marketplace as admitted companies get in and out of particular areas. And the surplus lines is there when it's needed. And it is and should be a carrier of last resort. The problem with the cancellation and non-renewal sections are that there's purely the time. There are several intermediaries in between the consumer, the purchaser of the insurance, and the underwriter, who many times is in a foreign country. Lloyd's of London would be a classic example. If a company is required to provide 20 days or 30 days notice prior to non-renewal, that would require the broker or the agent who's dealing with the insured to get the information pertaining to an application for renewal some 40 to 60 days ahead of the renewal date, and get that information to the underwriter in Europe some 45 days ahead of time. And as a practical matter, that simply never happens because that agent is required to make a diligent effort to try to place it with admitted carriers. So the underwriter in Europe then would be faced with a situation of either non-renewing, which of course is not good for the Oregon consumer, or to renew blind, which the underwriters are probably not going to be willing to do. And we feel if those timelines are applied to surplus lines carriers that we may find large portions of the market drying up. Other states have had that experience, and I have attached to the material that we've given to the committee some bills in three states which had to go back in within a year after passing legislation that did not clearly exempt surplus lines carriers and do so. Colorado, New Jersey, and Washington have recently all had that same experience and have had to go back in with emergency legislation because they lost this valuable form of coverage, which is not provided by the non-admitted companies. Other states such as New York, Delaware, and Illinois specifically exempted surplus lines when they passed acts very similar to what this committee is considering. And we put with the material examples or the exact bills from these other states where they had to go back and address these situations. And a couple of them have spelled out pretty clearly the reasons why it was necessary. Those two amendments are fairly small. The main thing we wanted to talk to this committee about is a proposal that this committee treat House Bill 3205 as an amendment to see engrossed Senate Bill 323. House Bill 3205 was introduced by Representative Miller of this committee and was sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary at the request of the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon. Unfortunately, the bill did not receive a committee hearing. It was assigned to the Consumer and Business Affairs Committee and simply did not get a hearing. It's a bill that provides much-needed protection for the insurance-buying public in the state of Oregon. Because of the similarity of the subject matter with Senate Bill 323 and because our belief that these protections are greatly needed, we urge this committee to adopt House Bill 3205 as an amendment. And the Insurance Department, the Insurance Commissioner's Office, joins with us and supports that request. That bill received the approval of Commissioner Kulongoski and previous Commissioner Driscoll. It simply is a bill that's long overdue. The current statutes regulating the surplus lines business are set forth in 744.305 through 405, and I've attached those statutes to the material that I've given to the committee. That section has not been updated since 1967, and it's very deficient in a number of particulars. Most importantly, it simply does not require the kind of financial security on the part of a surplus lines company placing coverage in Oregon that is now needed. It does not properly define surplus lines insurance, and it does not set forth duties and responsibilities of the surplus lines agents and brokers. The bill we propose does all of those things.
Mr. Chair.
Presently, in order to issue a policy in Oregon as a surplus lines company, a non-admitted company need only have $1 million in combined surplus and capital or a $500,000 trust account. Those sums are simply inadequate for the kinds of risks being placed here in this state. And surplus lines companies are not covered by the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association, so the people buying the policies do not have that backup protection, and the people who might be injured or who might have a claim against a policyholder do not have that protection. The new bill substantially increases those protections. It would require $3 million upon enactment, $3.5 million 3 years after enactment, $4.5 million 5 years after enactment, and $5 million 6 years after enactment. So it's designed to keep up with inflation. And it also provides important new powers to the Insurance Commissioner's Office to regulate non-admitted companies and to cut off those companies from placing policies in Oregon if they do not promptly and fairly adjust losses or if the commissioner becomes aware of problems with their financial security. And we've seen that happen with non-admitted companies in the recent past, and I'm sure the committee is familiar with it. For all those reasons and the other reasons we've set forth in the handout, we think this bill is very important and it deserves the attention of the committee and that the people of this state need it. We'll be here to answer any questions that you might have, Mr. Chairman, or other members of the committee.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for your written amendments and the fact that you've summarized your other materials here. This is what we hope to receive, and this is one of the few examples so far in terms of just how the material needs to be presented to us in the way that's hopefully going to accomplish your purposes and our purposes as well. I believe Representative Hanlon, you had a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. How do we know that the surplus insurers that actually end up doing business here or how can we have confidence that they're going to be able to have sufficient real verified information? So if the primary insurer needs to turn to the reinsurer, that there's going to be something there.
You mean in terms of financial responsibility? The new bill requires certain filings with the commissioner's office and that the commissioner satisfy himself as to that financial stability the same way that he does with admitted carriers.
Mr. Chair, what certain filings?
I'm sorry?
What certain filings?
I think I can answer that question. It's basically their convention statement or the financial statement.
The what?
Convention statement or financial statement at the end of each year.
And are these all filed under generally accepted accounting principles?
Yes, sir. As far as companies domiciled in the United States, they're filed on the National Association of Insurance Company, National Association of Insurance Commissioners form, which is a standard form that applies to all companies.
Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up.
Yes.
How do we know that, if I understand reinsurance, these people, those companies write where there's a very, very low chance that there'll be a loss, but for a very, very large part or large loss if the loss occurs. Is that a fair characterization?
Are you talking about reinsurance?
Yeah.
Actually, we have nothing to do with reinsurance as far as...
Then I'm confused.
Yeah. We are writing direct insurance.
Okay.
Here.
What's the difference between reinsurance and surplus lines insurance?
Reinsurance is a company that reinsures an insurance company. And they do not issue a policy to the public. A surplus line insurer is one that's not admitted in the state, but still issues insurance in the state. And they operate under the surplus line law.
For what kinds of risks? For risks that are not otherwise covered elsewhere.
Risks that are difficult to get in the normal admitted insurance market, such as excess insurance, taverns, quite a few risks.
Daycare centers, things like that.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me follow up.
Brooks St. Hamlin.
The kinds of risks that we see written by surplus lines and reinsurers could be characterized as high risk insurance.
Right.
Both of them.
That's true, although some reinsurance companies reinsure risk generally, but they are two distinct things. A reinsurance company just basically comes in and buys a percentage of the risk that's out there, whereas a surplus lines carrier issues the same kind of policy as an admitted company to an individual such as you or I who have been unable to find coverage for our particular endeavor in the admitted market.
You said that reinsurance merely buys a percentage of the risk, but I thought that reinsurance would much of the time not go on a percentage, flat percentage of the risk, but instead would take those amounts insured above a certain minimum. So your statement, I believe that
you're right, and there are different forms of reinsurance. And
so you said percentage of the risk, but that's not necessarily true.
Not necessarily true, I'm sorry.
How do we know that surplus lines are going to have enough bucks to come up with what they're supposed to come up with in case a loss hits?
It's the same way that the insurance commissioner determines that about an admitted company. Financial statements and so forth are filed. The new bill that we proposed as an amendment increases those filing responsibilities.
From what to what?
From presently $1 million in combined capital and surplus to $3 million upon enactment, and then with an increase each year thereafter up to $5 million.
So what are we guaranteed? Because you're not a member, the surplus lines are not members of the guarantee.
That's correct.
So what if there's a $100 million loss and you got $3 million in the pot? So what? What are you going to do to us? How are you going to guarantee it?
Well, most cases, they do have reinsurance. In other words, if they have a $100 million limit, which would be highly unlikely, they would have probably 90% of that reinsured somewhere else with other companies.
And how would that be guaranteed? Wouldn't be regulated by the state, would they?
There is no guarantee in the surplus line field.
One important change that I think the proposed amendment makes, this amendment, by the way, takes away no regulation of the surplus line industry. It substantially increases the control and regulation over that industry.
How much regulation is there now of the surplus line?
Very little.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wilson, I don't know, did you have additional comments, or Mr. Marks?
One thing I did want to mention to this committee concerning Representative Hanlon's statement about the Insurance Guarantee Association. The new bill requires that a policy issued in a surplus lines company state that in boldface type on the front of the policy. Presently, that requirement does not exist. Are there any further questions of us, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, there are, I believe. Counsel?
When you have the capital surplus requirement, is that money needed to be maintained physically in Oregon? Or is it a capital surplus requirement of the parent company and the parent company is out of state office?
That's right. It is
the latter.
Outside of Oregon, right.
Okay. My understanding was that at one point in time there was a surplus line association which was kind of parallel to the insurance division in terms of regulatory powers, power to admit or deny admittance to carriers. Has that changed over the years, and how do the two organizations interrelate? What authority does the insurance division have for surplus line companies?
Actually, we've been in existence since 1941, and we're a self-regulating association, and we regulate ourselves. In other words, we say the members all agree to comply with the laws of the state of Oregon. But the insurance department has complete regulation over us. There's no question about that. We are not regulating. We are just self-regulating, in the same as a bar association, for instance.
Do the insurance companies have to go through, the surplus line companies have to go through any formal procedure so they can do business in Oregon?
Basically, that's the responsibility of the individual broker, agent. And they have to furnish a power of attorney to the individual agent, gives that agent the power to accept suits. And they are asked to give us a copy of the financial statement, also the insurance department. That's about the extent of the formal.
Can the Surplus Line Association or the insurance division deny the right to do business in Oregon? And how does that happen?
We give them suggestions in the Surplus Line Association. The insurance department has the right to deny them the right to do business in this state. And they have in the past.
Mr. Wilson, in your second of your First Amendments, where you talked about exempting from the individual cancellation, I believe you would exempt surplus line carriers from the requirement that they can't cancel unless individual policies, unless a certain criteria is met.
That's right.
Is there any reason why surplus line carriers would have a special need to be exempted from that requirement? The cancellation one specifically of an individual policy.
The main reason is the willingness of these carriers to come in to the market. The association's concern is that we'll simply find them withdrawing from Oregon, which is a fairly small percentage of their market in this country because of our population and because of the small percentage of premium dollars that are collected in Oregon. If those kind of requirements are placed on them, I think we'll lose them as a safety net for otherwise unavailable coverage.
Okay. Is there any reason that a surplus line carrier might have for canceling an individual policy that an admitted carrier would not have for canceling an individual policy?
Can you respond to that, Barney?
I can't really think of anything. I was going to say that these requirements have been in the form of by the insurance department for the last 2 years, and surplus line is specifically exempted now from those rulings, and it really hasn't been a problem. We have not had any wholesale cancellations by surplus line carriers or non-renewals of any large extent.
One last question.
Sure.
When a surplus line carrier wants to come into a marketplace, I know we discussed this briefly the other day, but could you explain again the process for a surplus line carrier to get into the market would be found non-competitive so that they could come in?
Right. What really happens is that the surplus line agent in Oregon is the one that determines that. It's his responsibility to make sure he only uses solvent insurance companies. And if he makes a contact with a company, or vice versa, the company makes contact with him, and the company meets all the financial requirements, that company can begin doing business in this state. But the surplus line agent is the one that is the determining factor. If a non-admitted carrier wanted to come in here and do business, he wouldn't be able to do it without a surplus line agent. He just can't come in and say, I'll write all of your whatever.
But is there a formal finding that no regular insurance is available before the surplus line agent is allowed to write the insurance?
That's also lies in the hands of the surplus line agent. He actually signs an affidavit to the effect that there is not a ready admitted market for that coverage. And that's his responsibility, and it's notarized.
Thank you. Okay.
3205 increases that responsibility by specifically requiring a diligent search on his part and attestation to that before he can place that coverage.
Okay. Are there further questions for Mr. Wilson or Mr. Marks? Okay. If not, thank you again, gentlemen, for coming back, and thank you for the quality of your presentation and the written materials you provided us. And if maybe a couple weeks before we actually get into work session, but certainly your concern has been well expressed, and it'll be among the issues that are going to be placed on that board over there once we start working through the bill.
If we can answer any further questions that arise at any time, please call us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, I'm going to call our next invited witness today, and that is Mr. Ken Horner, President of North Pacific Insurance Company. Mr. Horner, thank you very much for your patience. I'm sorry it took a little time
That's
to get to
right.
you this afternoon. I kind of like your tie. It's a step in the right
direction.
Yeah,
I noticed that when you walked in, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe in trade after it.
My name is Ken Horner, and I am the president of the North Pacific Oregon Automobile Insurance Companies. Both companies are Oregon domestic carriers, headquartered in Portland, Oregon. The Oregon Auto, having been doing business in the state of Oregon since 1926, and the North Pacific since 1958. I'm here, of course, on this beautiful day to testify on Senate Bill 323. I would first of all like to address the tort reform portion of the bill, and then go into the what I would call the insurance reform section. We know that tort reform has been a very controversial issue here in the state of Oregon the past 18 to 24 months.
Can you tell us what your company writes in percentages? Do you write comp? Do you write auto? Medical malpractice, just so we get an idea of who you are.
Certainly, Representative Hanlon. Our companies write primarily personal lines, private passenger auto, homeowners, dwelling fire, mobile homeowners, and what we term Main Street type commercial accounts, that being primarily your shoe store, drug store, grocery store. We do not get involved in the heavy manufacturing type risk where you have heavy products liability lines, because we only do business in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and when the products get beyond those three states, we, you know, perceive problems. And so we try to write the kind of business we feel we can service and do a proper job. Some 70% of our volume is right here in Oregon, so we can't afford to make foolish mistakes. We want to provide good service
Do any of your companies write workers' comp in either Idaho or Oregon?
Yes, we do write some workers' compensation in Idaho and in Oregon. Our volume this year in Oregon will probably be around $2.5 million in premium. Idaho is probably closer to maybe $500,000. I'd have to go back and check those figures to be accurate, but we don't write all that much in the state of Idaho. We're going to write about 6 to 7 million total volume in that particular state. Does that answer your question, Representative Hanlon?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Homer, just along those lines briefly, can you maybe give us some idea for what your premium dollar was in 1986, just a ballpark? Or
In all three states?
If you have that figure, and then maybe more specifically in Oregon.
Yes. Our gross premium, that being direct premium written, was about $62.5 million. In the state of Oregon, $43,975,000. That's about 70%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Are you a domestic, Oregon domestic?
Yes, we are. We are owned by the General Accident of America. We became a subsidiary of the General Accident last August. Prior to that, we were owned by Armco Steel, and I can assure you it was a pleasant change. General Accident, by the way, is a property casualty carrier who does business only through the independent agency system, such as North Pacific Oregon Auto, and we're very compatible in all areas. In fact, they turned over their business to North Pacific Oregon Auto of the Northwest. Their employees became our employees January 1, so we are an autonomous company in Oregon, Washington, Idaho.
Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Are you then, you're 100% owned by a foreign company?
By a foreign company?
General Accident.
A U.S. company. Now.
Well, foreign means under the terminology the insurance commissioner's office uses.
Right.
You're 100%
there are
owned.
Foreign companies, though, and I wanted to.
Yeah.
That's a good point, because General Accident America is owned by General Accident of Perth, Scotland, so. We're a little both, I guess.
Foreign slash foreign.
Right.
Gotcha.
Do I understand that, now you folks are not a mutual, you are a...
No, we're not a mutual.
Investor-owned?
We're a stock company. 100% of North Pacific stock is owned by Oregon Auto, and 100% of the Oregon Auto stock is owned by General Accident of America.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for allowing these interruptions.
That's fine. Getting back to the tort reform.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Oregon General, your parent is what?
General Accident of America.
And they're 100% owned by General Accident of Scotland?
Right.
And who owns the corporate equity in that Scotland corporation?
Stockholders around the world, I would assume, Representative Hanlon.
Where is that stock traded?
Traded, I would assume, on the European Stock Exchange or whatever term they have on it in Europe. I'm not that familiar with the stock market in Europe, so I can't give you a real good answer to that question.
Well, if I may follow up.
Representative Hanlon.
Then what you're telling us is any profit that your company produces is generally created, albeit by a wide market of people, but generally traded, and the profit, the people that make profits from your company, somewhere in Europe.
Well,
would that be a fair summary? If you make a profit here, it's the matter of investment on a European equity market.
No, not necessarily, Representative Hanlon. For example, North Pacific Oregon Auto, the surplus, the profit that we make, and we haven't made any for the last 4 years, so I use that word loosely. With except last year, we did make a slight profit, and I'll be glad to go into that later. But when we make a profit, that goes into what we call policyholder surplus. That surplus is used for additional growth in the territories that we do business in. Now, you're right in the sense that the investments...
Wait a second. Policyholder surplus is, if I buy my policy from you, you're going to give me a dividend.
No.
Well, then you better define what a policyholder surplus is.
The surplus that an insurance company makes
goes into what is termed policyholder surplus. That surplus is there as financial backing for our obligations. We reserve losses. Sometimes those reserved losses are not adequately reserved. When that
it's a contingency to cover in case you have more losses than you estimate.
Right, and to finance new growth.
And to finance more Oregon operations and the advancement of your corporation.
Right.
But the, if I may follow up.
Representative Hanlon.
But the ultimate, assuming that grows, the ultimate equity and market that the subject of that growth is traded on, what you told me, being 100% owned by a U.S. corporation that is in turn 100% owned by a Scottish corporation, is the matter of growth is reflected in the European market that is traded, where the common stock for the Scotland company is traded. Wouldn't that be fair?
I can't say that's entirely fair, because I would assume, and like I say, I don't get involved in what goes on in Scotland. We've only been owned by this company since last August, and unfortunately I haven't had the opportunity to go to Scotland yet, but hopefully someday. But resolved. And insurance companies, historically and rightfully so, they predicate their rates based on experience. And until you get to the point where you see how the reform is going to affect the experience, I don't think you're going to see a great deal of rate decrease. I think hopefully in the area of availability, you would see some improvement there. And I know there's pros and cons. I called the insurance commissioner in Washington yesterday morning, Mr. Marquardt, to ask him what effect, if any, he had seen as far as the tort reform effect on availability in that particular state. And he said that on governmental entity type business, there was some companies that came in after the reform, primarily because of the deep pocket theory. They stayed away from them prior to the reform. And on the smaller cities and counties where they could underwrite the business properly, they were writing that line of business. Daycare centers was another area. He said the rates were substantial, but there was a market for daycare centers. So, in my honest opinion, you would not see an immediate rate decrease. I don't think we should try to sell that, because I don't think it'll come about. Not in the immediate future. I think it will eventually, for those lines of business that more hazardous, the longer tail of liability on them, it will have a stabilizing effect on the rates, and maybe even rate reductions. But only time is going to tell that. I think in Washington, the insurance commissioner is required to maintain data until 1991, and then at that time report back to the legislature as to the effect the reform had on the insurance market. So and I think that's probably, I think this bill contains like a 2-year provision for the commissioner to analyze the results.
We've had one actuary appear before the committee, and one thing we found out is that those folks are few and far between.
And expensive.
It's hard to hang on to them. So I feel like we've been very privileged to have the one appear about a week ago, one evening. I asked that gentleman to give me a ballpark estimate of the impact of the cap on non-economic, and he suggested at that time that perhaps it would be up to 20 years before the $500,000 cap would actually impact rates. Is that?
Well, that sounds rather lengthy, to say the least.
Okay, let me pursue another area. You suggested that rates are based on previous experience. It seems that some of the information that we've come across indicates that previous experience in the past, especially when there's been that highly competitive market for dollars, previous experiences had nothing to do with the rates. That's not what insurance companies have based the rate making on at all.
Okay.
Is that
Was there more to that question?
No, go ahead.
Representative Dix, I think that we all know that any industry has a percentage of what we call crazies. Companies that do operate on a cash flow basis. And there were some companies that did that, and I think that when that happens, eventually, if it takes place over a long period of time, that you'll find other companies who would find that very distasteful in their day-to-day operations are forced to maybe not take a rate increase when actually it looks like the experience would warrant it, because they know they're going to lose all their business. That happened to us. Mm-hmm. We lost $5 million in prime commercial lines business during this soft market. But we drew the line. We said, we'll go this far, and we're not going to go any further, because we know we've done business in the state of Oregon since 1926. We know what it takes to make a buck, and we can't make a buck on these rates. So we held the line.
But your company, being a reputable company and having the experience here in Oregon, made that decision. But weren't there reputable companies who faced that decision and perhaps wrote bad policies, which later the tails were still feeling the impact on those, on policies that should have never been written because of the interest rates at the time and chasing that dollar, getting that investment dollar? I mean,
I think that's basically true. I think that they were
just
the minority, though.
I mean, that's not casting aspersions on their business practices, but just to stay competitive, because you pointed out here you lost $5 million worth of business, drawing the line where you drew the line. I mean, perhaps, and that perhaps was the prudent decision, but someone else with just as reputable a company might have made another decision to continue going down that trend line and writing cheaper policies at that time. Is that?
Well, the number of companies that are doing business out there that could be, the case.
Is that, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not an insurance person, so bear with me, but the graphs I've seen indicate that regardless of what this committee does, that we're going to enter one of those valleys again in the future where you have that highly competitive, I guess you referred to it as a soft market. Is there anything contained in 323 or 324 that would stop reputable companies from chasing the dollar to the point of having to come back up the hill and making a decision one morning that, my God, we've got to raise rates so substantially that it blows people clean out of the water if they own a small business, for instance?
Representative Dix, I think presently the insurance commissioner has the authority to, when a company files a rate, to come back and say that's not justified. I don't think they've had the staff, the police, every single company in this state as to whether their rates can be justified or not. It seems to me as though a company should have to justify any rate reduction. They should have to justify any kind of a credit program that they're applying to accounts for good management, loss experience, or whatever. In fact, we're required to document our files as to why we gave, say, 20% credit on this account. The loss experience over the last 3 years, or if you schedule credits, the management, housekeeping, whatever, that is supposed to be documented. I cannot tell you if all companies document it, but I would say unless the commissioner checks and makes an audit on those companies, you would find that some perhaps do not. And the rates that they charge on a given account may not be justified. And I think that's where our problem lies. I think the commissioner needs to have the staff, the resources to adequately police what's going on in the industry.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
The Oregon Mutuals, the North Pacifics, the Safecos, those companies that have a large presence in the state of Oregon, those are the companies that are going to be audited the most because from a geographical standpoint, we're handy. The people don't have to leave their homes for 3 months to perform an audit in New York or Hartford, Connecticut or wherever. We have an audit about every 3 years. We had one about a year ago. Oregon, Washington, Idaho all had their auditors come in as a team, and they were in office some 3 months. We pay their expenses while they're there. and we've always come out in very good standing in our audits. We have to. We cannot afford to lose our business in this state or in Washington, Idaho. We'd be out of business if we did. But there's companies that I know fudge, and they fudge because they know that the likelihood of getting caught is not it's not there.
Mm-hmm. So you just think that the commissioner at this point needs more staff and better implementation of the rules and regulations that are already and statutes that are already on the books?
I do, and if there's anything in addition to what is now available that he can determine is cost effective and it's going to really be helpful, then I would have no objections to, you know, those being added.
Is it your understanding that at the present time he has the authority to veto, for instance, insurance hikes, price hikes?
If he, you know, they have the authority, as I understand it, if you submit a rate increase, you take a rate increase, and you still have to supply the documentation as to, you know, why.
Mm-hmm.
And if they feel that is not properly documented and it's not justified, they can come back and ask you to amend your rates. I think that's a better approach because, first of all, I guess the rate increases through without a lot of red tape, and like I mentioned earlier, without the possibility of maybe having to double up or taking a higher rate increase.
The commissioner is quoted in the Register Guard on the 19th of February asking for more power to veto insurance hikes, and the article's fairly general, so I'm not even certain what he's making reference to, but he seems to imply in the article in the Guard that he doesn't have the authority right now that he needs to actually veto an insurance hike. And also suggests in the article...
Is that for all lines of business?
No, it was for... It doesn't say. The article doesn't say.
Well, I can only tell you that when we file rate increases or decreases, in fact, we filed a decrease in Washington on homeowners here a few months ago, because we increased the deductible, and our loss experience did not really justify that decrease, and they turned it down, a decrease, mind you. When it comes to increases in this day and age, if it's significant, I think it's going to get the proper attention if they have the staff to do it with. That's why I say that I think that a lot of communication needs to go on between this committee and the commissioner's office, and maybe a committee made up of a few people from the insurance industry that have a large presence in the state of Oregon here to really determine what is practical and what is not practical. And if it's practical, hooray. If it's not, then I don't see any need to put it in there. Why make people jump through hoops and waste money, which is going to be reflected in rates and tax dollars?
You suggested at the outset of your testimony that the call for tort reform, the public outcry for tort reform was the reason why we were here. Mr. Kramer was here the other day from New York, who was involved in putting together Governor Cuomo's report on tort reform and insurance reform. And he suggested in his report that, in fact, what occurred during 1982 through 1984 provided the impetus for the telescoping of rate increases in through 1985, and that in part was some of the reason why the crisis occurred and the huge rate increases occurred in 1985-86. Would you agree with that, and that it wasn't just the tort system or jury awards or verdicts going through the roof, but in fact there were some problems within the industry that would cause...
Representative Dix, I think that it's a combination of both. I really do. And that's... nothing will make me happier to see the size, if you will, bury the hatchet and sit down and be reasonable and look for a common result that's going to be beneficial to all. It's something that you can argue until it freezes over. And you're never going to know who's right and wrong unless you try some things and see how it works out.
In fact, Representative Bunn made mention of the fact recently that it seems like every witness that appears before us, and I would agree with him, has a new set of statistics and figures. And at some point, I share his, I mean, he's been at it a lot longer than I have, but at some point, I too share his desire to throw all of them on the ground and walk away, because we don't know whether to make heads or tails or any of it. The insurance industry has a story, and the trial attorneys have a story, and the physicians in my community have a different version and different statistics, and you really don't know where to come down on the issue. Getting back to your initial remarks when you started your testimony out, you mentioned that you think the tort system is responsible, and I'm curious what leads you to that belief. You may have made mention of it in your testimony, and I might have missed it, but what do you have some statistics or data that would indicate that the tort system is partly responsible for it, for the crisis?
The reason that I feel that the tort system as it stands today in Oregon has contributed to the problem, and I say contribute because I mentioned that, you know, I think everybody played a part in this, for the most part. But the system as it stands today, where there's no limitations, where do you find the predictability? I mean, how can an actuary predict any kind of maximum loss when there's no limitation? I guess it's kind of like me giving my wife a checkbook and say, well, I'll cover it at the end of the month. You know, I put so much in, she knows how much is there to spend. She can predict her, but she does.
Let me just interrupt you there. You mentioned earlier that you set your rates usually based on previous experience. If you have a graph that indicates that awards follow the following patterns, wouldn't an actuary use that previous experience as a way to dictate rates? For instance, if you had four malpractice cases over 10 years, med malpractice, there were four verdicts, and they averaged $100,000 over 10 years or 20 years. Couldn't you use that as a way to set rates? Wouldn't an actuary look at that?
I would look back 30 years ago, I know we had actuaries at that time, although we were not right in this particular line of business, but those companies were manufacturing asbestos. Were their actuaries able to predict the losses and include that into the rates? No, they were not. And I would suggest that we have other things out there that are going to be as bad as asbestosis. Well, another. So if you don't have any maximums on there, and as far as joint and several liability is concerned, I could write the best risk in the world, mm-hmm. and assuming that they're not going to be negligent too many times over a period of years. But if they're a small degree negligent, they could be stuck with the whole loss. And I don't think actuaries can predict those kinds of things.
Because of the case that you mentioned, the asbestos case in particular, and what has happened, don't you think insurance companies are a little bit more careful in writing their policies today than they were 30 years ago? Because people have pursued, through the civil justice system, some remedy for, or have some recourse for the damages that were incurred due to an asbestos, for instance?
I would say that is basically true. I think insurance companies nowadays have the vehicles to do a better job of underwriting.
I guess that's one of the problems I have with caps per se, is it seems that you're suggesting that in the future there may be product liability which is as great as that was incurred in the asbestos or is incurring in the asbestos cases, and we have to somehow protect the insurance companies from that responsibility of making sure that their clients aren't producing products that are damaging workers or citizens by capping what those citizens through the civil justice system, what remedies they can receive through the civil justice system, we have to cap in order to protect insurance companies. I guess that's one of the biggest problem areas I have, is it's funny that you should mention the asbestos in particular.
The
actuary didn't know, but neither did the people that had the damages incurred to their body due to the asbestos. They didn't know either what was going on in many instances. So it's a two-way street.
Certainly it's a two-way street. And as far as economic damages are concerned, I don't believe there should ever be a cap.
as far as the non-economic damages are concerned, I think there's a limit to everything in this world. And whether it be $500,000 or whatever, I don't know. I guess, and I'm not a cold-blooded person at all. I have three sons, and I worry about their welfare and my grandchildren and friends and so forth. But I guess if all your bills are paid for and you were to get $500,000, you'd be a lot better off than those poor people up in the Betts Hospital that are burned, scarred, maimed. They didn't get $500,000. So I guess, you know, we have to look at it from the standpoint of what is fair for all concerned. I don't want to appear cold-blooded because I don't mean to. But I guess that's what I'm saying. I think there's a place for a cap on non-economic damages.
So, let me, if I might just quickly...
We can try to wrap it up here. We've got some other questions.
Go ahead. Representative Burton's got some questions.
Representative Burton.
If I can just ask my questions, I have to get to another committee hearing. And the cap question, of course, is a very emotional one. And I realize your company doesn't write those lines. And most cases are settled out of court on issues like this anyway. But would you comment on the fact that if you set a cap, that there may be a tendency for that to be have the same effect as rent control? That is, people tend to go to the top of the question rather than below that, so that if we set that out there as a maximum, that you're going to have more cases found at the maximum than you are less than that, particularly if the jury is aware of what the maximum award is. And that, in fact, puts you at a higher degree of risk.
I don't think that would be the case. I think that probably most cases where the injury is severe, the prayer in the complaint is now is usually more than what the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney fully expect to get. At least most times they're settled for less than what the prayer is. And I think in most cases the awards are much lesser than what the prayer asks for.
So what,
I guess only time would tell. I that's just my personal opinion.
If that's the case, then what's the point of the cap? If, in fact, they usually found it at less than that, then what's
the point of the cap is when the company is, and I'm, again...
An actuarial tool?
You were not here when I started my testimony, but I mentioned that my company does not write the lines of business that normally would be impacted by this particular tort reform in Senate Bill 323. But if I were to write governmental entity business, or I'd be more prone to write governmental entity business or any other line if there was a known maximum on non-economic damages. And I think that's the way most companies look upon it. And I think that's what's caused the unavailability.
It's not a rate, it's an availability question.
Right.
The cap would tend to give you, to say, there are more companies would tend to write more lines or write that line if, in fact, the cap exists. So it becomes an availability question rather than a rate question.
I think if you were to be writing the heavy products lines, that perhaps the punitive damage change would be beneficial in predicting the losses and what rates would be charged.
I have just a couple of minutes. I know there's some other questions. Mr. Horner, I appreciate your patience, but as
no
you
problem.
Said, we got a great interest in this area, and we're learning, and your comments are helpful. It's my sense that in terms of caps, maybe I should start with a question. In terms of your personal lines, like your homeowner's policy, what's the general maximum limit in terms of payout that you folks would provide if a person were found liable, say, in a homeowner situation?
Oh, I can think of a couple situations where we paid, I think, policy limits, and we write limits up to a million on homeowners, and then we'll provide an umbrella above that if the insured, you know, feels that they need that.
I'm thinking, you know, the backyard swimming pool drowning. I don't know if you exclude that kind of coverage, but, you know, those are the kind of catastrophic losses that may hit a homeowner. And yeah, I think you've indicated that do you write that $1 million cap or umbrella or excess as a matter of course, or what's your standard homeowner limit?
Now, when we write a homeowner's, if the premises, in fact, we won't write one unless we feel comfortable the premises are well maintained and that we have a responsible insured. And we have no qualms about writing 500,000 or $1 million limits. We know that the chance of a claim is somewhat remote, and we do have reinsurance. Earlier, when the other two gentlemen from the surplus lines market were testifying, you had a number of questions on reinsurance, and I think most of us carry reinsurance. We pick a retention that we feel we can absorb without creating financial difficulty for the company, and when we reach that limit, we reinsure everything over and above that. So, and the reinsurers, knowing that homeowners are not in the same class of business as malpractice or heavy products liability lines, they're not fearful of providing the reinsurance on that line of business. I think when you get into more hazardous lines, here again, the reinsurance market plays a pretty important part on what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. And the reinsurers, you've all read their comments. They feel tort reform is necessary because that's where they get involved, is, you know, when you have the big jumbo loss. And if the companies cannot get reinsurance, they cannot write that line of business. And there again, you have the availability problem.
Representative Hanlon?
Just a couple. First of all, I'd just like to say the asbestos cases are not the best example, because in the 20s and 30s, there were medical researchers that did work for the companies involved and found great dangers of carcinogenic effects, and those effects were put in the dark archives of the companies involved in the production of asbestos. And one could certainly argue there was an intentional misrepresentation there on behalf of the corporate interest. And that ultimately culminated recently with John Mansfield petitioning for the safety of the bankruptcy courts, and as I recall, some of the insurers involved denying coverage. So, I don't know, when you inject asbestos, I think asbestos was one of the biggest frauds ever put into production in this country, based on its history. But, question.
I don't think we're holding Mr. Horner responsible.
No, we're not.
I hope not.
No. It was like a Representative Dick's question, I believe, and I just wanted to refer to that particular product example as something that might even be called an intentional wrong or hiding by a corporate manufacturer who knew of safety problems and did nothing except bury them. Nonetheless, my question, Mr. Horner, on surplus and excess insurance that appears to be have very little regulation in this state, as opposed to those companies that, like yours, that's a domestic, and those foreign companies that write policies that are not a part of the non-admitted. Why do we have to treat insurance companies as one of them we don't regulate or have a heck of a lot to say about, and the others like yours we've got a bunch of power over? Why are there two different classes? Is there a good reason that we as a state have a right to regulate you a heck of a lot more than we have a right to regulate Company B because they're either a reinsurer or a surplus lines writer? And do you have any reaction to that?
I'm not an expert in the surplus lines field, Representative Hanlon. I think, from what I've read at least, that this is the way it's handled throughout the country. It's not unusual to the state of Oregon. And I have a feeling that because of the nature of surplus lines, they write those kind of accounts that North Pacific will not write. North Pacific would not have the reinsurance facilities to write, nor the expertise to underwrite. So probably in a lot of cases, a surplus lines market may go to a number of companies to get reinsurance on a particular risk, and because they have that unusual situation, they need the flexibility to do so. And I think they have competition within the surplus line markets. We have, when you have an agent that we cannot write an account for, he'll usually or she will go out and get two or three other quotes from surplus lines markets and place it with the company that's the most competitive. Did I answer your question?
I think so. I just want to switch. Assuming that the tort system, where there is a large verdict exceeding $500,000 to $1,000, or $500,000 to $1,000,000, some people have written that there is some value to that within the safety provisions, especially in the commercial lines where manufacturers and products lines can be ultimately encouraged, regardless of what the safety regulations are, to produce safer products, and that a $2 million verdict may have an ultimate effect of producing safer products for the market, and analogously within a company that may be sued and a large verdict rendered, that the tort system, without the caps that you're speaking of, would ultimately be cost beneficial to society because of the improved safety involved. Because if I'm a manufacturer and I see my brother manufacturer that had a $2 million verdict, and I'm competing with that manufacturer, his product's going to be better, and so is mine. Ultimately, we will have fewer, if the damages are quadriplegia, we'll have fewer of those costs to pay over the long run, because the next